Great news for the world. Chapter 4. All Change. The last time our friend Evelyn came to see us, she brought along her pet rat, Cleopatra. My wife and I, like most other people, have always felt a revulsion for rats. Previously, we could never understand how anybody could grow fond of a rodent. Within half an hour, Cleopatra changed our attitude. But then, Cleopatra is no ordinary rat. To begin with, she is beautifully clean, well-groomed, and fully house-trained. Her standards of personal hygiene would put any dog to shame, and many cats, too. Evelyn has given her a thorough examination in the pathology lab at her college, which Cleopatra passed with flying colours. She was found to be carrying far fewer germs than the average healthy human. Cleopatra is surprisingly affectionate. When she snuggled under her mistress's chin, or rolls over so that her tummy can be tickled, she looks a picture of contentment. Watching her, you feel that here is a creature who has reached the summit of ratty happiness. She's come a long way from her cousins living a poor-to-mouth existence in garbage jumps and sewers, riddled with vermin and disease, and in daily peril from traps and poison, dogs and cats. But if you are able to communicate with a wild rat, and often offer to turn him into a pet like Cleopatra, he would probably laugh at the suggestion. What? Give up my way of life and take on a new one? No fear. I don't want to be washed and disinfected and trained and bossed about by some human. I'm all right as I am. I'm free to do just what I like, and I want to stay that way. Thank you. Freedom, that's the life for me. Prisoners all. We must not press the parallel too far, because human beings are not rats, and in many important ways are very different indeed. Yet the fact remains that many people do have an attitude very like that of the indignant rat. They talk about freedom as if they possessed it, but they don't. None of us do, not even in the most liberal democracy on earth. Like the sewer rat, we're all prisoners of our environment. If I'm blinded in a car crash, or if a terrorist bomb blows my legs off, there's nothing I can do about it. I should have no choice but to go through life horribly disabled. If I contract leukemia when I am young, or my heart fails when I'm old, then I'm not free to do anything but die. If I see the world drifting towards a nuclear holocaust, I am free to weep at the prospect of an end to civilization, but I'm powerless to prevent it. Even if I were a prime minister or a president, I should still be a prisoner of circumstances. Freedom, real freedom, just does not exist in this complex world of ours. After all, we are the prisoners of our own temperaments. Everybody knows what Paul meant when he wrote to the Romans in chapter 7. Though the desire to do good is in me, I'm not able to do it. I don't do the good I want to do. Instead, I do the evil that I do not want to do. What an unhappy man I am. It's not only religious people who sometimes feel like that. Agnostics and atheists are aware of the same sort of conflict within them. The ability to think in terms of right and wrong is one of the qualities that distinguishes man from the animals. Fair play. This possession of a moral faculty is one of the most remarkable things about human nature. But even more extraordinary is the way that nearly every human being on Earth seems to feel quite strongly about what is usually called fair play. A sense of fair play is not the same thing as a sense of right and wrong, although, of course, the two are related. Different civilizations have always had very different ideas as to what constitutes right and wrong. So have different individuals within any group. But there has always been an astonishing measure of agreement among mankind as to what constitutes fair play. For instance, people differ as to whether a man should have one wife or several. People differ as to whether it is permissible for a married man to have affairs with other women. But everybody, everywhere, agrees that the man who leaves his middle-aged invalid wife to starve, while he runs off to the Bahamas with a wealthy young widow, is a rotter. Similarly, people argue as to whether it is right to drop bombs on enemy cities in wartime, knowing that lots of innocent women and children will be killed. But everybody, everywhere, agrees that the soldier who betrays his own comrades in the middle of the war, just because he sees his own side losing and wants to move over to the winning side, is worse than vermin. Then again, opinions may differ as to whether the legendary Robin Hood was justified when he robbed the rich to feed the poor. But everybody, everywhere, despises the rich man who steals the pennies from a blind beggar's tray. These three examples all point to the same conclusion. A dirty trick is a dirty trick all the world over. And so far as history can tell us, it always has been so. Perhaps this seems to you such an obvious fact that you wonder, why make so much fuss about it? There is, in fact, a very good reason for stressing this point. We live in a world where Christianity has been on the defensive for hundreds of years or more. Atheist philosophy has made it difficult for millions of people to believe in God. The importance of the fact outlined above, this stubborn, inescapable fact that practically all men everywhere despise dirty tricks, is that it cuts atheism down to size. The main plank in the atheist platform is the belief that the theory of evolution explains all the mysteries of life. There's no space here to discuss whether evolution is a satisfactory explanation for the existence of the lower forms of life. All I can hope to do now is to show that man cannot possibly have evolved from the animals, because evolution would have been bound to produce a race of men that admired dirty tricks and despised fair play. Survival of the dirtiest. The basis of the theory that man evolved from lower animals is the principle of natural selection, or, as it is often called, the survival of the fittest. In very simple terms, natural selection is thought to operate like this. Every so often, some chance reshuffling of molecules, technically known as mutation, occurs. This causes an animal to be born with some advantage over its fellows. For instance, a lion might appear with a heavier jawbone and stronger jaw muscles than the other lions. In normal times, this well-endowed animal gets more to eat than his neighbours. In times of famine, he really comes into his own. Then the strong-jawed lion grabs the only available piece of meat from his weaker, hungry brother. The well-fed lion gorges himself and lives to reproduce his kind, while the hungry one starves to death. A dirty trick? Of course. That's how natural selection is supposed to work. The survival of the fittest really means, so far as the higher animals are concerned, the survival of the dirtiest and the trickiest. How, then, did man come by his love of fair play and his hatred of dirty tricks? If atheist philosophy is correct, our ancestors survived because they excelled in dirty tricks. Yet we have acquired a deep distaste for dirty tricks, a revulsion against the very process that is supposed to have formed us. Clearly, the atheist has a tremendous problem on his hands. Taking the argument a stage further, how is it that a great many men and women have respect for unselfishness, kindness, compassion, and conscientiousness? They may not practice these virtues very often themselves, but at least they admire them in others. Yet these high moral ideals are a positive handicap in the struggle for survival. If the atheist's explanation of our origin is correct, then these virtues should have died out long ago, along with our love of fair play. Like the strong lion, the iron-hard men, whose watchword was, "Might is right and I don't give tuppence for anybody else," should have been the only ones to survive. Their brash, self-centred descendants should now be occupying the whole earth, if the atheists were right. As it is, mankind's widespread respect for what has been called the law of decent behaviour shows that man must have been created by some great lawgiver. The explanation that fits. There is an account of man's origin in the early chapters of the Bible that makes remarkably good sense. Though there are problems in reconciling Genesis with science, it can be done, and the outcome is an explanation that really does fit all the facts. It begins in Genesis 1, which tells us that the first man was created in God's own image. This immediately sets the human race apart from the rest of creation. Man alone can commune with God, understand what God requires of him, and consciously obey God or disobey God if he chooses. Man alone was created in a very close relationship with his Creator. Luke 3 reads, "Adam, the son of God," he was called that. No wonder man has a sense of fair play. Then God put this first man, Adam, to a simple test. God said in Genesis 2, "You may freely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it you shall die." We do not know what would have happened if the first man had obeyed God. The fact is that he did not. Genesis 3 tells us that our ancestors sinned, were sentenced to death, and were expelled from God's presence. These events are presented to us as historical facts. Jesus Christ evidently accepted them as actual history, and I have never seen any convincing reasons why we should not do so too, even though we do not know their date or their geographical location. This record in Genesis is extremely important because it teaches a lesson affecting all human life, including our lives today. What happened to Adam and Eve happens, in one way or another, to every one of us also. As the New Testament explains, in Romans 5, "Sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin. And so death spread to all men, because all men sinned." Children of Adam. So the whole human race is in the same unhappy position as Adam. He started off on the wrong foot, and the whole of mankind has been on the wrong road ever since. He went astray and received his double punishment, immediate banishment from God and the certain knowledge that one day he would die. No doubt Adam went out from the presence of God sorrowfully, his mind filled with memories and with thoughts of what might have been. He never for one moment would have imagined he was gaining his freedom. He knew he was losing it. Eden, the place where God walked, was the place of freedom. To him, the rest of this wonderful world had become one great prison, a place to live in sorrow until at last God's sentence of death took effect. It is tragic that so many people nowadays are unaware of their real position. They cannot see that they are in just the same situation as poor Adam, sinful, condemned by God, and thrust out from his presence. Yet there is a powerful evidence that this is so. We still bear within us the signs of both our lofty origin and our tragic fall. Our deep-seated love of fair play is the evidence that we really were once created in the image of God. And the way we keep tripping up, failing to play fair, despite our good intentions, is proof that we belong to a blighted, sinful race. These facts about the origin of mankind explain why so many of us go through life dissatisfied. It's as if we are always searching frantically for something that eludes us. Materially, men and women in the Western world are better off than ordinary people have ever been before, but they're still discontented. The real prizes, peace of mind and lasting happiness, are always just out of reach. This is because we have forgotten what we were searching for. We know that something is amiss, but we don't know what it is. We've lost sight of the fact that the world is really a prison, and that we are the prisoners serving out our sentences. Finding freedom. When I saw clean, affectionate, contented, happy Cleopatra, I felt sorry for the wild rats of the sewers. But there was nothing I could do about it. The sewer rats do not know what they are missing and have no wish to change. It's beyond human power to turn any of them into another Cleopatra. God must feel something like that when he looks at the human race. He would like to lift us out of our prison, clean us up, change our habits, train us, and one day give us the perfect happiness that we yearn for. That is just what Jesus offered people, real freedom, as we read in John 8. If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. His listeners bristled. Like the wild rats, they considered they were free already. Reading on in John 8, "We have never been in bondage to anyone," they slammed back at him. Even the Son of God could do nothing with such people. He continued for a while trying to shatter their complacency, but it was of no avail. Before long they were threatening him with violence. As Jesus told them, the truth could have made them free. But the truth about themselves was painful. It nearly always is. They chose to live in a cloud cuckoo land and pretend there was nothing wrong with them. So do most of us, most of the time. But unless we can somehow break free of that habit, we shall let slip the most precious thing in the world. Everlasting happiness. Everlasting life is a subject that is very much misunderstood. Sometimes people think of it as little more than a continuation of our present tear-stained existence. This often leads them to conclude that perhaps eternal life is not really worth having after all. Others look upon it as a sort of king-sized Christmas present that God will hand out one day to the people who please him. And since God is good and kind, they often conclude that he will probably give that gift to everybody, or, at any rate, nearly everybody. Both these ideas are terribly wrong. Everlasting life is best thought of as everlasting happiness or everlasting joy, which is how the Bible describes it in Isaiah 35. The Bible also tells us that this happiness will be enjoyed in the presence of God, as we read in Revelation 21. Now you can only find great happiness in someone's company if you've grown to love that person. Cleopatra's idea of bliss is to be cuddled and tickled by her mistress, but a sewer rat would run a mile rather than submit to human caresses. In the very nature of things, then, everlasting happiness can be enjoyed only by those who have, so to speak, grown to enjoy God's company. We can only do that by letting him teach us how to enjoy being with him. And that means letting him do a tremendous job with us. To begin with, we must recognize that this world of ours really is a prison, and a very foul one at that, and that because of our disobedience, the sentence upon us is just. We must allow him to lift us out of the filth, wash us, and set us going along a very different path. We must let him turn the rest of our life into a training course, gradually developing in us the sort of character that really would enjoy living forever in his presence. Total surrender. God is a perfectionist. He insists upon giving us complete cure and nothing else. And that calls for total surrender on our part, as the Bible puts it in Romans chapter 2. I implore you, by God's mercy, to offer your very selves to him, a living sacrifice, dedicated and fit for his acceptance. Adapt yourselves no longer to the pattern of this present world, but let your minds be remade and your whole nature thus transformed. Romans 12, verse 1 and 2. Those who decide to surrender their lives to God, like this, are often surprised. It's not the painful process that many of them expected it to be. In many ways, it's a delight. But then the Lord Jesus Christ promised that it would be. Matthew 11. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. Despite this, only a very small minority of mankind has ever been willing to submit. Jesus knew that this would be so, as we have recorded in Matthew 7. The gate is wide, and the way is easy, that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow, and the way is hard, that leads to life, and those who find it are few. At first sight, those are discouraging words. A narrow gate, a hard way, few people finding everlasting life. Why, this is indeed a daunting prospect. Don't despair. This is only one half of a complex picture. Look back a few lines to the previous quotation and see how the Lord also said that his yoke is easy and his burden light. In the next two chapters, we shall begin to see how the two halves of the picture fit together.